Welcome to Transforming Education, Leadership Lessons. This podcast is hosted by Northwestern College. We're bringing you thought leaders who are influencing education and the world around them. Each episode provides new leadership lessons, so you can learn how to embrace your own influence.
Leadership has nothing to do with title or position. That leadership has to do with impact. And the role of a leader isn't to create followers, it's to enable more leaders.
Take away leadership qualities that inspire.
I think good leaders really get people brought together around a cause and can inspire them to be better than they were yesterday or to do something great.
Care about others.
We need teachers out there that are caring and compassionate and are interested in the student beyond the discipline that they're teaching.
Show people they matter.
We don't have a bullying problem. We don't even have a gun problem. We have a mattering problem.
By knowing you matter.
You matter to yourself first before you can matter to someone else.
So further your impact.
When you just authentically love your students, I just don't think you can help but grow.
Understand your core values.
You can tell pretty quickly any core leader whether or not he or she is there for the mission at hand, for the people that they serve, or whether they're there for themselves.
And align your mission.
Everything we do on campus, whether it's someone in the maintenance department or someone teaching in the classroom or to coach, it should tie back to our mission of impacting students for the cause of Christ.
Discover how to use your influence to inspire others.
That is why the relationships is so critical in everything we do, because when people know you care about them, they know yet they have your best interest, and then it sinks in.
Let's welcome our host, Gary Richardson.
Thank you, Leslie. I want to thank you for listening to Transforming Education, Leadership Lessons, where we bring in thought partners to inspire and influence your leadership. In this episode, we will be discussing leadership lessons with Dr. Lori Barron and Dr. Patty Kinney. Lori is currently the superintendent at Evergreen School District in Kalispell, Montana, and was recently named Montana's Superintendent of the Year in 2021. Patty has been a teacher and administrator at the middle school levels in the state of Oregon, where she was named the National Middle Level Principal of the Year in 2003. Patty was a past associate director for the National Association of Secondary School Principals and now serves as an educational consultant, speaker, and author. You can access Patty's resources at pattykinney.com, all lowercase, pattikinney.com. Patty and Lori joined together to co-author the book We Belong, 50 Strategies to Create Community and Revolutionize Classroom Management, and is the reason for our request to be guests today. This concept of creating community fits with our current series on addressing diversity, inclusion, and equity in our schools. And we're fortunate and grateful to have these two with us. So welcome to the podcast, you guys. And would you mind letting our listeners just get to know you a little bit better by sharing a little bit about yourselves?
I guess I'll start out. I was a elementary and middle school teacher for 16 years. And then an assistant principal and principal of the same middle school for 17 years. And all those were in Southern Oregon. After that, I retired and moved back to the Washington, D.C. area, where I worked for the National Association of Secondary School Principals and headed up their middle level program. I live in Cottage Grove, Oregon, where I grew up. Actually have been married a little less than a year to a wonderful man that I went to first grade with.
Okay.
Yes, so I'm Lori Barron, and I'm the very proud superintendent of the Evergreen School District in beautiful Northwest Montana near Glacier National Park. I spent the first 6 years of my career as a high school English teacher after graduating from the University of Georgia. Go Dogs. And then I was a middle school assistant principal for 2 years and a middle school principal for 9 years. And all of that was in the same district in Georgia. During that time, I met Patty because she had been the 2003 National Principal of the Year, and I had the honor of having that same opportunity in 2013, and we did some work together through the National Association of Secondary School Principals and have kept that friendship and collegial relationship up since then. After 17 years in the same district in Georgia, my family and I followed a dream to Montana. We had vacationed here for many years and had planned to retire, and decided not to wait. And so I am in my ninth year as the superintendent of the Evergreen School District. So I'm in my 26th year. I've been in two different districts in very different areas of the country, but all great work for kids, and just excited to be here to share a little with you today about the work Patty and I continue to do together.
Well, your dogs do have a big game this weekend.
They do.
Oh, by the way.
They go Ducks.
You can, Patty. It's not the same, but you can. Yes, we have a fun game day on Saturday. I still have season tickets to football. So we don't get to go a lot, but we're not giving them up.
We're all pretenders when it comes to Georgia football, right?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
we are.
You had mentioned a little bit about your connection, and it may explain my question about the book, but how did you agree or decide on this topic and the strategies that are involved in the book?
Well, actually, this is the third book we've written together.
Okay.
We started out and were asked to write a book by World Book Incentive Publisher on helping parents understand what the core was really all about. And then we had such fun doing that we both of us have a strong middle level background. And we decided we wanted to write something about middle schools. And so we worked with Association for Middle Level Education, and they published that book called Middle School, A Place to Belong and Become.
Okay.
And out of that, ASCD approached us, said, we'd be interested in you writing a book for us. And we said, well, what kind of a book are you looking for? And they said they were interested in something along the lines of classroom management. And I'll be honest, our first response was, how can you do something different in classroom management? There's a lot of stuff out there. And the more we talked about it, we realized we could use a lot of the information we had researched and put together for our middle school book and focus on belonging, because that is so important. And helping teachers understand that if their practices and their voice and their words are geared towards helping kids feel like they belong, it's going to build a classroom that is not only more cohesive, but usually has less behavior management problems.
Sure. So in your book, you include the definition for belonging as the perception one has of being accepted, valued, and included in a particular group or setting. You also go on to say that school belonging has been described as the extent to which students feel personally accepted, respected, included, and supported by others in the social school environment, which we might think is a pretty normal definition. But you make the point that belonging matters and creating belongingness is something that can be intentional. Can you share a little bit more about that?
I think it's important to remember that all of us, regardless of our age or role, usually want to fit in. We want to matter. We want to belong. And that's not to say we should lower standards or cave to peer pressure to fit in. It's to say we really believe that who we are matters and that we want to belong. And we've all been in situations where we feel we don't belong. It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. It helps erode self-esteem and confidence. And too many students feel that way about their school. You know, it's not a place where they feel accepted, and therefore they can't learn to the extent that they're capable of learning. And I think it's important to think about it. Even in students that maybe project strong success, you know, a star athlete, a stellar student, the kid who is running the SGA, the Student Government Association, if that kid's sitting alone at lunch or doesn't have someone to play with at recess, I guarantee you they feel less successful than what their accolades may show.
Absolutely.
And so, there's a quote we used in our middle school book that we think sums it up nicely. All people need a place where their roots can grow deep and they always feel like they belong and have a loving refuge. And all people need a place that gives them wings to their dreams, nurturing possibilities of who they might become. I think the key is, how do we create that belongingness? There's not a silver bullet. Every strategy doesn't work in every situation. We would never claim that after having spent a combined 60, 70, 80 years in education. But we do believe it starts by fostering a culture where students feel respected, where they know that their thoughts and opinions matter, even if others disagree with them, and that they know what they're learning is important. It's not just sit in a circle and sing songs to feel good. It's about mattering and being valuable and knowing what they're doing is important. And so we've got to remember that as educators, all of our words and actions send a message, right? We want to be cognizant of what we say and how we respond to students so that we're not sending a message that they're not important and that they don't matter.
Right. We were fortunate to do a podcast, Leslie and I, with Angela Myers probably 18 months ago. And in that, Angela said, we don't have a bullying problem in this country. We don't even have a gun problem. We have a mattering problem. You hit upon that well with creating a sense of belonging. So I appreciate that. You also write about creating spaces that are physically and emotionally safe for all. I think we all might have a vision for what that looks like, but you kind of laid out a few details of what that looks like, and can you explain that for us?
Well, one is, if a student doesn't feel physically or emotionally safe, the likelihood of behavior issues increases. And part of this book is about revolutionizing classroom management. Yep. And so that's crucial. Students are more likely to act out or respond inappropriately if they're afraid of being physically bullied, picked on, even assaulted. It also holds true if they're afraid of being verbally bullied or the target of gossip because of their appearance, their race, their disability, anything about them that makes them stand out. I remember taking a class, this will show my age, from Madeline Hunter back in the day.
And me and too.
She was wonderful. I think she got a bad rap in some ways because her stuff was taken and written in concrete. And I can remember her saying, I never intended for this to be written in concrete. But she made this statement that's always stuck with me, and that a child would rather be seen as disruptive than disgraced. And sure. How we treat kids and work with them makes a huge difference because they'll come out fighting. One of the summaries in our book that I want to share a little bit about, it's crucial that educators establish a climate early on that promotes safety, both physically and emotionally. There's a little summary I want to read from the book that speaks to this. And it says that each student should leave your classroom the first day of school believing the following. I'm going to be safe here. We're going to be serious about learning, treating one another well, and getting along. Everyone here matters equally. Learning is going to be active and creative. We're going to work together as well as on our own. I can be academically successful here. We're going to be heard. My ideas, interests, and experiences matter. I'm going to belong here. I want to come back. Wouldn't it be amazing if every child walked out of their first day of school thinking that about their school experience?
It certainly would. You mentioned restorative practices and trauma-informed practices, and I think those are terms that are new in the last few years and get a lot of lip service, but I'm not sure that we know how to use them. Can you shed a little light on how you would suggest that we would use restorative practices in our classrooms?
And you're right, restorative practices is more of an emerging social science. And a great website that I have used regularly and I would want to credit is iirp.edu. It has a lot of resources, iirp.edu, on restorative practices. And it talks about how restorative practices is an emerging social science that studies how to strengthen relationships between individuals as well as social connections within communities. And the whole idea behind restorative practices is that something is happening with the person who has misbehaved, made poor decisions, instead of something just happening for them or to them. And so instead of the teacher or the administrator, you talked, here's what happens, or you talk, so I'll move you. It's you talk, so what can you do and how can I help you not talk out of turn again? And I use a silly example there. But the idea that we're helping the student restore, and you know, that last point that Patty made about students wanting to come back. When a student has misbehaved, and sometimes it's out of attention, sometimes it's out of lack of other needs being met. When you have a classroom management problem, there's embarrassment that comes along with that. And when we're able to restore others' belief in us after we've misbehaved, you can feel a little more pride in, hey, I made that right. Think about it. When you do something wrong, if you have an argument with a colleague, your spouse, a friend, and you leave feeling guilty and just yuck about it, there's something about that restorative practice of owning it and going back and saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have treated you that way.
Sure.
And we want to give students that same opportunity. We don't want to assume, because they're young or immature or don't have fully functioning executive functioning skills, that they can't do that too. We want to be able to say to them, hey, what happened? What were you thinking? How do you feel about it? How have others been affected? What do you want to do to make it right? Instead of us choosing all that, this is what happened and this is what you're going to do to make it right. When we allow students that opportunity, no matter how serious or insignificant it may seem the behavior is, they can own that and feel good about themselves for trying to make it right, which helps them then feel like, I still belong, I still matter. Just because I made a mistake doesn't make me a bad person. And so I think it's really critical that we give them that opportunity. I think sometimes in the rush, I mean, gosh, you've got 30 kids looking at you. Several of them are asking questions. You know, it's a busy time. We just want to address the misbehavior and move on. And what it does is it only maybe silences it for a moment, but it doesn't help improve the behavior long term because the student hasn't owned it and said, I feel that I shouldn't have done that. I feel remorseful or regretful about that. And so therefore I'm going to work not to do it again. So if we can take the time to help walk students through the restorative practices, we not only improve that student's feeling of self-worth and belonging, we also improve overall classroom management and the community of our classroom.
Sure. So I read an article on the restorative circle or the circles that are used. And Lori, you're addressing this more on an individual basis of the teacher and the student as far as restoring that student's perception of what went wrong and doing it in a way that also credits them for or dignifying their response. That seems like it's a little harder to do than getting everybody in a circle, although that would be hard. But the restorative circles, to me, would seem a good way to get everybody together, but still you have the power of the strongest personality in the group and the shyest.
Yes, the power of a restorative circle is that you balance that power, right? Because you can only talk when you have the talking piece. Everyone gets the talking piece. And so, you know, kind of pass a baton or a ball. And if you're holding, you talk. And if you're not, you're not. So everyone gets equal opportunity. And it really balances out because you're sitting in a circle and you're making eye contact. And you can also use several different strategies inside of a circle where everyone gets the opportunity to give input, to share feedback, to, and you can use it for an academic subject. You can use it for a, how are you feeling this morning? So restorative circles are super powerful for before you have behavior concerns, right? To help prevent them. So certainly agree with you that that's a strong tool to use to create community and include every student.
Yeah. So, Patty, I also ask about trauma-informed practices, and I don't know if either one of you have any specific techniques that you use or strategies. Again, trauma-informed classrooms is trendy, and rightfully so. It also, in my experience, it's rare that you find someone that can give you specific instructions on how to do that. It is, this is why we need trauma-informed, but what are the strategies that principals and teachers can use?
I'm going to let that go over to Lori. I'm aware of the practice. I know that my former school district where I worked has put it into place. But as you said, it's a trendy thing. And I've been out of the classroom and out of the school doing specific work with kids where Lori has been in the trenches. So I'm going to let her work on that one.
I think we're starting to realize you'll often hear people say, well, we didn't have that problem when I was in school. They should just deal with it. That's not what we got. Yep. We were in school. And I think what we've realized is over the past several years, decades, that more and more students are coming to us having faced adverse childhood experiences. And it's often abbreviated ACE or ACE.
Yep.
So the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, helps us look at different adverse childhood experiences that students had that may have induced trauma, right? And when we can see students having come to us with trauma already in their lives, it really helps us to be able to address those individual needs that a student has that aren't about whether or not they like your content or your class. They're bringing so much trauma with them, it's hard to get past that. And so there's a lot of emphasis right now. One of the strongest strategies that we're seeing, particularly in our area, is the infusion of mental health care certified staff infused into the school. Mm-hmm. Instead of students having to leave the school to receive mental health care services, it's part of their schedule, just like they go to PE or math. That has been super effective because you've got mental health care experts who really understand traumatic childhood experiences and are able to help students address those. And then they can also work with staff so that they can say, hey, when you have Lori in class, consider this type of strategy. When you have Patty in class, consider this. And so there's not a one simple strategy. I think it starts with awareness that that's what students are coming with many times. And then how do we work collaboratively as adults for those of us who don't have the background and skill set in mental health to improve what we know to individually meet students' needs?
Yeah, so we actually see this as a void in our graduate program, that particular topic. And I'm interested, this semester, we have 2 8-week courses on classroom strategies to help traumatize students. And person that we know, Jolene Filo, has agreed to do that and has established the curriculum. I'm really excited to see what the reaction is to the course and if it becomes a little bit more popular. But I appreciate your understanding of that and sharing that with us. So today we are visiting with Lori Barron and Patty Kinney, authors of We Belong, 50 Strategies to Create Community and Revolutionize Classroom Management. In our podcasts with educational leaders, we consistently hear the phrase student voice and choice. It's used over and over. Rarely, again, do we get brought into how we actually apply the concept. You provide a strategy in your book. Would you mind sharing that process with us?
Yes, but I want to start with a leadership story. And because I know this Perfect. Is about leaders. And I want to challenge leaders to be sure they are modeling voice and choice with their staff and with the adults they work with as well. And I'll give you a quick example before I go into classroom stuff. I was thinking this morning about this question, and I remember being an administrator in an administrative meeting. I was a principal, and our superintendent had made some comment about, let's do something this way, and we're gonna do this and that. And I thought for a minute, and I said, hey, what about this? Could we possibly do it this way? And there's a little of exchange and goes, oh yeah, that sounds like a really good idea. Later that morning, a new administrator to our district came up to me and said, I can't believe you challenged the superintendent on how to do something. And I said, what? You know, it was so common in our district to be able to do that. The district that this person had worked at, whatever the superintendent, whatever the principal said, that was the law.
Sure.
So are you modeling it with your staff, that the people you're working with? You know, giving students a voice and choice can be simple as, you know, letting them pick a book that they want to read, or it can be giving them an open-ended research project to complete on a topic of their choice. You know, to start with the process with kids, you have to think about it. It has to be intentional. You know, that you're going to build in opportunities for students to give their choices in what they're going to learn, how they're going to learn it, and who they'll work with. Now, it's not open-ended. You first have to assess the readiness of your students. That's number one. You know, are your kids, you know, first graders are going to be a lot different than seniors in high school. When I was a teacher at middle school, I received kids in my sixth grade class from five different elementary schools. And within 2 weeks, I could tell you which elementary school those children had come from without going into their records to find out, because it was a big continuum. On one end, I have the students from an elementary school that was much more structured. The kids always came up to me, is this the way you want me to do it? Am I doing what you're asking? Is this okay? And at the other end, I had kids that just, oh, okay, and took off on their own. They were given more opportunities to have voice and choice in their learning, and it showed up by the time they got to my sixth grade. So, you know, it's gonna look different. You've gotta look at it. With little kids, maybe you're gonna start between two choices. Give them more choices as they mature in those skills. Listen to students' concerns and interests, you know, and infuse opportunities for student voice throughout your lessons and your content. It can be as simple as, oh, I remember the old math assignments, you know, that came at the end of the chapter that you were, when they were using books and things, and you had to do so many problems. And it's like, you know, choose if you want to do the even ones or the odd ones, or choose 10 problems that you'd like to do to show that you know this. You know, it doesn't have to be the same for everyone. Give them that opportunity. And then offer choices. According to age, it might be narrowed down menu or completely open-ended. For example, if they've been studying the different forms of government, ask them to individually or in a group come up with a way to demonstrate that they understand that concept. You know, there's opportunities for them to do self-assessment. Just infuse it in, be deliberate about it, look for opportunities, and listen to your kids just in informal conversations. What are they interested in? What are their concerns that they have?
Very good. And including the students also gets them into the culture, makes them feel like they belong, right? A little bit of ownership draws them nearer to the people in the building. You have provided us in the book with over 50 strategies for building community. If you had to give advice to an aspiring principal or teacher, what would be the one, two, or three go-to strategies that you have to have?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because Patty and I lived in this book for a number of years, sharing our passions and thoughts and ideas. And when we finalized the chapters, you know, I'll start with three chapters really stood out to us. Of course, we think all seven are meaningful, but chapter two is about trusting relationships. And that whole idea of relationships is just so critical, because if you don't have that relationship, it's really hard to connect and to get that buy-in. And I guess one from that chapter that really stands out to us is strategy 10, get to know your students. It's much easier to connect with and teach students that you know. You know, allowing yourself to be a little vulnerable, getting to know students and letting them get to know you professionally and appropriately. And I guess I would say strategy 10, getting to know your students. Another chapter that stands out is consistency. Gosh, sometimes we cause our own problems. We wonder why in a classroom lesson or in trying to get students to try a new skill or demonstrate knowledge, why it goes awry. And sometimes our own inconsistency as adults really, it takes us off track when we could have settled it early. And so, you know, something for me, and this is maybe a little more biased because it's also instructionally based, but a big one for me is that strategy 27, post a daily agenda. I think keeping yourself on track and helping students see where you're going, no matter the age, is important, and they can rely on it every day. And it's so simplistic. You know, it's the easiest simple lesson plan you can do, but it guides you each day and guides them each day. And they know every day coming in, I can look and I'm going to see, what are we doing today? And it's not how, it's what. And then I guess the third one, you know, Patty, I've talked about this a lot, is that student-centered instruction. Quality, engaging, student-centered instruction will help take care of a host of possible classroom management problems. When we looked at that student-centered engaging instruction, strategy 39, which is practice dynamic instruction, really stands out. We need to work to be our best each day to expect students' best. And when we're using, when you think about get to know your students, have a consistent plan, and then practice dynamic instruction, it builds that community. It decreases the likelihood of classroom management. It helps each student feel like he or she belongs, and it ends up improving outcomes for students, not just academically, but socially, emotionally, cognitively, behaviorally. It's hard to pick three since we wrote 50, but those are three that stand out to us.
Yeah, thank you.
And the idea is, if you're going to start somewhere, those are good ones to start. The book isn't written that there's 50 strategies and you've got to do all 50 of them. You know, you're going to go in and look at it, and you're going to have strengths and you're going to have areas of concern. I guess we picked these three because we thought, especially with early on teachers, beginning teachers that you're working with, those three seem to be the ones that hit the nail on the head, that if you get those in place, the others will also come.
Yeah. So,
and they don't have to be in order. As Patty said, you can pick and choose, you know, as you need them.
Oh, they don't have to be in order. Someone like me would just look 1 through 50 and just let's go check this one off. And
you can go in order if you want, but that's probably gonna be a pretty rigid, not flowing classroom.
That's true.
And well, not meeting the needs of your students.
I wanted to piggyback on your comment or the strategy of posting a daily agenda. In my superintendent days, I had developed a handbook for instructional strategies. And when Patty, you talked about Madeline Hunter, a lot of those strategies follow that, as well as some other people that we have had in our trainings. We were also into the Elmore instructional rounds at the time. So what we had our instructional rounds group do as they went around the buildings was look at what I call beginning of the day strategies. So as Lori mentioned, it was, do you have an agenda for the students to look at? Do they know what they're doing for the day? Do they know how long they're doing it for? Because some will look at the agenda and go, oh, we're doing that today? Well, but we're only doing it for 5 minutes, I can handle that. And then the process of repeating directions, which you have in your book, the strategy of getting the students involved with choice, whether it's a partner or something else, and then the closure activities that come at the end after instruction. My point is that when we were done and we were debriefing the instructional rounds, so at the end of the instructional rounds, one of the people that participated was a special ed consultant through our Area Education Association. And she said at the very end, what you don't realize as I've gone through these classrooms is the special needs students really are engaged, because they need the consistency and the structure of the beginning of the day activities, the daily agenda, the expectations of what's going to happen are laid out for them. And that not only goes with special needs, I would think. It's those students that come to school that have had something happen, those that are shy, all of those fit into this. So when I read the book, all of those things resonated on effective strategies for classroom instruction. And I appreciate the work that you put into that. So you guys did a great job with the book. What's one thing you're working on right now that might surprise our listeners?
I don't know about surprise, but we're always considering topics for our next book or what we can do. Our first book we wrote, we didn't do this intentionally, but our first book was published in 2015. And then 3 years later, our next one was published in 2018. And then coincidentally, this one has been published 3 years later in 2021. So I think maybe we have the 3-year mark to figure it out.
Yep.
But right now, we're just really enjoying talking with people. We've had so many people reach out, just like you did, about the book and asking questions. You know, we've been discussing and sharing webinars and podcasts and book studies and presentations and keynotes over this book. So I think the surprise to us, perhaps, while we were passionate about and confident in the content of this book, is this, the response that we've received. That's been super exciting for us to be able to give back to the educational community. We obviously have a passion for this, and we've been working together for a number of years, both on these topics and some other ones. And we've had the opportunity to do a lot of work together and separately, of course. So we're excited to just give back to our education community through opportunities like this. You know, we're still learning and growing. And even though we've been in this for a long time, and Patty has since retired, and I'm in year 26, there's still new stuff to learn. And I was like talking with our oldest daughter last night, who is an art teacher in Georgia, and she's a second year teacher. And she said, I just don't think people understand that you've got to take care of kids and their social, emotional needs before you can teach them. And I wanted to crawl through the phone. I was like, yes, that. I think that we're preparing student teachers and new teachers so much better than maybe what we did decades ago for that. And to think that she already gets that so early in her career is super exciting. And so anything that we can do to help contribute to that concept of belonging and mattering, we're just looking forward to sharing more about this book and then maybe planning our next project that we'll aim for 3 years.
Oh, that's good. Well, I'm really excited to know how you would respond to one of our last questions. And that is, what did the pandemic show us about equity, access, and inclusion that we need to build upon?
Yeah, you know, Patty and I have talked about this one a lot. The irony is, when we started writing this book, we started with just brainstorming and what was important to us. And we knew we felt like the concept of belonging was so critical. And when we were tying that to classroom management, there was a little bit of, when we were working with the publisher, of how does that tie in? And as we had finished kind of the draft of the book, it was the basic draft, still a lot of work to do, but it was in February of 2020.
Okay.
And the pandemic hit in March. Mm-hmm. We kind of had to set it aside for a little bit. You know, we were closing schools and teaching from home, and plans that Patty and I had professionally were derailed. And when we finished and sent off the final draft of the book, it was because we'd already written it. And we were like, oh my gosh, this is what the pandemic has called for, a need for. You know, when students had to go home and they weren't with us and they only had their resources at home, even if we sent them with devices and we were calling, we could start to see the issues of inequity and students not being included and students not feeling they were a part. It was so much more difficult for students to feel connected from their home than it was when they were here together. And while we understood the health and safety needs, we were very grateful last year in our district, and I know many districts didn't have the same opportunity, but while we did remote learning from March to June of 2020, in the fall of 2020 and all through last year, we remained open every single day last year for students.
Uh-huh.
And we did have some students doing remote by choice or necessity, but we were open full time. And when we were able to see students learning remotely versus students learning on campus, the pandemic really revealed to us where some of those inequities were and issues of access and full inclusion. And so as we were finishing the book and sending it off to the publisher, we were like, gosh, this addresses exactly what we should have been doing all along, but what we definitely need to do as students return to our classrooms after having perhaps been isolated or not having access. And so it gives us the opportunity not only to address what we realized during the pandemic, but improve previous practices that maybe we could have done a better job of to begin with.
The other thing it did was drive home the diversity of our students. And Lori addressed some of these issues. You know, I'd had relatives that the kids loved working remotely. You know, that just was their thing. And I have others who just, you know, blew it off, didn't learn well because they didn't have that self-drive. The access, the inclusion pieces, I think it really made people more aware of what we need to do to address the individual needs of kids.
Yeah. We always ask, and our listeners really look forward to this, what you're reading. Outside of 50 strategies to create community and revolutionize classroom management, what are you reading?
I'm going to start with that, and I'm going to be utterly honest and say that I'm not reading anything right now. My life has been really hectic this last year, rather chaotic. My house burned down in a wildfire in Oregon last September. I got married. I moved. I've lived in a fifth wheel and building a new house, and I'm in the new house now. But I just have not had time to deal with professional reading. So, Lori, share your books.
So I've got two that I'm looking at that I'm reading right now. One is Building Strong Human Bridges, 10 Tools for Success by Harry Amend, that I've just started. So I can't even give you any kind of review, but I like the idea of those human bridges, that strong connections. It resonates with me obviously we have a passion for that belonging. And the other one that I'm trying to read, which you shouldn't try and read two at once. This is from two really good friends of mine that I've gotten to know professionally, Michael Lubefeld, Nick Polyak, and their friend PJ Capozzi, The Unfinished Leader, a school leadership framework for growth and development. And this one, The Unfinished Leader, speaks to me because I have a real strong belief in coaching and growth. We do a lot of coaching in our district for teachers and administrators, and I do a lot of coaching for people. So The Unfinished Leader really spoke to me of what I can continue to do to grow as a leader. And so looking forward to finishing that one as well.
Very good. Well, thanks you guys for joining us. I appreciate it. When we're done with the edits, I'll let you know and then we'll post it and you'll be able to do what you want with it as well.
Thank you.
This was great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah.
When I saw it on Twitter, Patty and I were talking about, we were like, oh, this will be cool. And this is a great example of what we mean of, you know, hopefully being able to give back to our educational community.
Absolutely.
With stuff like this. So thank you for the opportunity. And if there's anything else we can do to help, let us know. We look forward to getting the link from you.
Yeah, you guys have been
great. Thank you for helping us get the word out. Not just the book, but the message of the book. That's important.
You're very welcome. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Thanks to Lori Barron and Patty Kinney for giving of their time and sharing their wisdom as we reflect on leaders that inspire and influence education and our world. So, Leslie, what are the highlights that we heard today?
Yeah, it's a wonderful conversation. I love the work doing around belonging and mattering. And as I mentioned, it's human need. We all have this desire to feel like we belong and that we matter, not just in what we accomplish, but that we, who we are, matters. And we're all created worthy of that. So developing that in our students is so crucial and fostering that intentional culture first, that they know that they feel respected, that they know what they're doing is important, and that they feel valued and that they matter in being in that classroom and being in a space that learning is happening. And also creating that space emotionally and physically in a safe way. You set that climate really early on that they said this quote, they'd rather feel disrupted and not disgraced. So knowing that our students feel both emotionally and physically safe despite their backgrounds or experiences.
Yeah, that was really good. I'm interested to check the website, iirp.edu, for some trauma-informed strategies. I think that was a good tip as well.
Yes, and restorative practices. Understanding that when something happens behaviorally in our classrooms, that our students understand that it's happening with them, our actions to rectify that, and not for or to them. That they have a say in really understanding what happened and how they can make it better, and that not only helps them understand that worth and belonging, but helps the class as well through that experience.
Was there any reading there that stood out for you?
We also talked about student voice and choice, and as leaders modeling that first with our staff and then also within the classroom, making sure that students have some choice in their learning and
also that means taking an interest in their interests, which also comes back to belonging and mattering. And as we talked about all these strategies, they narrowed down three to really start with that are at the basic level of building this community. And one, to get to know students in that trusting relationship, having a consistent plan, and third, practicing dynamic instruction that is student-centered.
Yeah, those are really good. And the consistency I've found is probably the most important for all students. The students that do school well, they can move and adapt as they go into each classroom that's different. It can be different. The consistency is where our students that are marginal really need the help and just survive much better in a classroom setting if they know what's going to happen. And it's consistent, that's for sure.
Exactly. And the book's recommended, Building Strong Human Bridges by Harry Amen, and The Unfinished Leader, School Leadership Framework for Growth and Development.
Yeah.
We all are unfinished, aren't we, in our leadership and growth. So those sound like fantastic books.
Leadership is ever-evolving and a moving target sometimes, and so those skills are important. Thanks so much to all of you for listening to Transforming Education Leadership Lessons. As we've said many times, you have many options for podcasting, and we appreciate you spending time with us. As a leader in education, you matter, and how you lead matters to a whole bunch of people that you serve on a daily basis. You were created for significance. Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Mike, for helping with the podcast today. And for Leslie and Mike, this is Gary. Until next time, inspire and influence.